You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
It is indeed. It's time to talk to, well, time to listen to our talk with Andrew Little about treaty settlements, education around the treaty in terms of creating a more in-depth treaty reparation process and demystifying the kind of effects of the treaty, as well as Pride Week and talking about the recommendations made in the United Nations Universal Periodic Review to Aotearoa 2 weeks ago. And yeah, here he is. Three countries, Chile, Australia and Iceland, have highlighted that we have problems that need to be addressed, and that problem predominantly is our treatment of the LGBTQIA+ and rainbow community. Chile recommended that Aotearoa end medical procedures on intersex people without their consent. Iceland recommended that New Zealand add gender identity, gender expression or sex characteristics as specifically prohibited grounds of discrimination in Article 21 of the Human Rights Act 1993, and Australia continued in a similar vein to the recommendation made by Iceland. How does the government receive recommendations of this like, and what will be done with these recommendations?
We have had recommendations arising out of the Universal Periodic Review before. When we were last reviewed in 2014, we had recommendations, I think 155 of them. I think we're looking at something like 200 on this occasion. And a lot of countries who make recommendations, that there is a common theme amongst them. But certainly, when I was up there, the countries who spoke after I presented, the issue of having explicit recognition of discrimination against intersex, transgender and others as a prohibited ground under our Human Rights Act was raised. It's something I've already indicated that the government is looking at, is going to review, will review the Human Rights Act, and I expect we will have legislation specifically about that. Look, it might be over the next 2 years. It's unlikely to be this year. That may well be next year. So we have a commitment to doing that. I wasn't quite clear about what Chile was getting at. The basic rule here is if you don't have the capacity to consent, then unless it's a medical procedure that is required for the preservation of life, then it doesn't happen. So I wasn't quite sure what they're getting to. No one is subject to surgery related to their sex or sexuality without consent. It just would not happen.
Why do you think these three have been highlighted so specifically then?
I'm not sure. I mean, there were a lot of recommendations. I mean, I think partly when I presented, I acknowledged that, you know, the areas where we know we have work to do, certainly when it comes to family violence, and that's a big part of our work, and I was able to report on the work that Jan Logie is doing. Also, Indigenous rights, as they describe it, and so treaty rights here and the rights of Māori here, that's an ongoing sort of piece of work, successive governments working, as I think as a country, with our greater awareness and understanding of the treaty. We're, you know, redressing the failures of the past, but also creating a foundation for the future. So I think that all that stuff was understood, and some countries made recommendations of it. But some obvious things that stick out is the fact that our Human Rights Act last, you know, was drafted in 1993, hasn't been reviewed significantly since. And, you know, some of the prohibited grounds of discrimination, the way they are defined and described, are a little bit out of date, and we don't have this explicit prohibition on discrimination on transgender and intersex folks. So, and I think people want to see that that's absolutely clear. I know legal advice that the previous government had was that it's already covered under the very general provision, but there's potentially some doubt about that, and I think we'd better just tidy that up. So that's something that we can and which we'll do.
Certainly. In 2017, the Department of Corrections was banned from marching in the Pride Parade as organisers said that they hadn't followed through on promises to improve support for LGBTQIA plus prisoners. This came a year after a meeting between the Pride Board and Corrections, where both parties agreed to come up with ways to support transgender prisoners. These recommendations, as of last checking and as of public discussion, still have not been met or implemented. From this, I have two questions. When it comes to recommendations on human rights, which I would argue that both the recommendations from the UNPR were, and as well as the ones made by the Pride Board were, what differentiates what will be taken on board by the government?
Oh, well, actually, well, certainly when it comes to the Universal Periodic Review, we have to report back to the UN Human Rights Committee on what we've done in response to each of the recommendations that we've received. So, look, that will happen, and that does those recommendations do lead to a program of work and, you know, sponsored by the wider government to make sure that we are, you know, we were fulfilling our obligations under the human rights charters and international conventions. So there will be a response to that. And likewise, if there's been an agreement between or a discussion between the Pride Board and Corrections and understandings or undertakings have been made, then I would expect that to have been followed up on. Corrections comes under a different ministerial portfolio, so I don't oversee what Corrections is doing, but I'd certainly be keen to see what response has been made in light of both the conversation with the Pride Board a couple of years ago and indeed on any other recommendations that we've had from any other quarter. I know that that is a challenging issue in our prison system, is to ensure that not only the facilities are there but the environment is safe for intersex prisoners and trans prisoners. And look, I will certainly follow up and see exactly what is happening in that regard.
Certainly. I believe, yeah, that Corrections is Minister Calvin Davies' portfolio.
That's correct, yep.
And I believe as well this conversation may have taken place, or I'm pretty sure it took place under the prior government. Moving forward, a large amount of discussion has been conducted over the last week about introducing compulsory Māori colonial history into the New Zealand education system. This is kind of continued on at Waitangi. Do you think that the inclusion of educational policy like this should be included as part of treaty settlements as well, or reparations, to further the depth of treaty reparations beyond a financial level and show that New Zealand is making more than what some are labelling token efforts?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. I know the issue of the way the school curriculum works, that it is, core competencies that schools have to ensure young people are equipped with, but they don't prescribe the content of the lessons, and so, you know, schools are free, I guess, to overlook or to not teach our colonial history and Māori and European history. I think that's unfortunate, because I think we all do need to understand exactly how this, you know, how we've got to where we are today. I think that, you know, there's an amazing resource being built up as a result of treaty settlements, and that is just through the historical accounts that are agreed between iwi and the Crown when they come to reach the settlement of their grievances under the Treaty of Waitangi Negotiations provisions. So there's a resource being built up. I understand that there's some effort now to pull together cultural material that tells those stories, and so there's a bank of material. All of that should lead to history teachers and social studies teachers saying, yeah, actually, there's a heap of material around about this, and we should get on and do that. So, look, I would certainly like to be encouraging of teachers and schools to take every opportunity to teach that history, because we have a growing amount of resource there for it. I'm not quite sure how you do that, the way kind of curriculum and instructions go out to schools about, you know, what they teach and how they teach. The whole curriculum is centred around making sure teachers can kind of harness their innate kind of energy and enthusiasm and curiosity. And that's why we don't prescribe content in a lot of cases. But you would think, growing up in New Zealand, the one thing you'd want to do is learn about our origins and those, you know, fundamentally important historical events like the Te Tiriti o Waitangi, as well as He Whakaputanga, the Declaration of Independence in 1835.
What would you say the public perception of Te Tiriti o Waitangi is at the moment?
Well, my sense is I think there's a widespread kind of understanding and acceptance that this was, you know, this agreement that was reached that allowed British settlers to establish government in exchange for offers of protection and tinawaranga teretanga, so a level of control over what they owned and what they had. And then, you know, equality before the law. Those were the essential promises made. And I think there's a growing understanding and acceptance that that wasn't fulfilled. Those promises weren't fulfilled. And the failure to do that, the alienation of land from Māori and the marginalisation of Māori and the social and economic deprivation that Māori communities were placed in as a consequence of government policies is something that we have to account for and provide redress for. I think there is more acceptance of that now than there was certainly 40 years ago, possibly even 20 or even 10 years ago. But we have, and I think most people accept that we have a long way to go.
Do you think that further education on Te Tiriti would help the wider population and kind of understand the effect that it had on creating some of the statistics that you mentioned in your UN PR review?
Totally. I think it demystifies it. I think, like, for some, I don't know, when I was growing up, the treaty was this mysterious thing, and certainly when I studied history in what would now be described as years 11, 12 and 13, we did very little New Zealand history. And so my understanding and knowledge of the treaty was close to zero. I learned more after I left school through my own study and meeting people and talking about it than any other thing. So I think more education about it demystifies it, but also I think education helps to understand, now when we talk about colonisation, you know, what that actually meant and what it did to Māori. There's something profound happened to many Māori communities when they had their land ripped from them, confiscated from them, or when they were herded and pushed into parts of the country that they didn't have a connection with. And then when those who were kind of resistant to what was happening, then, arrested, detained, often for lengthy periods without trial, Taranaki Māori being sent down to Dunedin to be jailed because it was colder down there. I mean, some hideous things happened to Māori by the New Zealand government of the day to kind of send a message or to punish or do whatever. And it goes deep to the spirit of Māori and what it is to be a Māori. And it is very, very hurtful, and that hurt has been handed down through the generations. And we've got to understand that in order to come to terms with it and understand why the healing process that the treaty negotiations process offers is so important.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.